Susan, can I bring you home so you can tell this to my mother? She would appreciate the introduction. But thank you very much for those warm words. About 25 years ago, the following true story occurred. There was a group of Hadassah ladies who were on their first mission to Israel. And that day, it was a very hot day in July, they were going to tour Jerusalem. And they were also going to tour the old neighborhoods of Jerusalem, including the neighborhood of Mea Shearim. And the tour guide told them the night before at the hotel that they should be careful, make sure to dress modestly. And not all the women understood exactly what that meant. And so when they came that next day, they dressed as modestly as they understood the quote-unquote recommendation to be. But when they got to Mea Shearim, it was clearly not modest enough for the standards of that community. And as they got off the bus, the tour bus, a number of local residents started to speak very harshly to them and say to them, you know, this is not a tourist attraction, this is our neighborhood, and you're being offensive to us, and please leave. And there were a number of the women who started to get back on the bus, but there were a number of women who did not take well to this statement or this request to leave. And they said, no, we have come to Jerusalem, and we paid good money, and we want to see the neighborhoods of Jerusalem. And one particular person, one particular chassid came up to them and said, we asked you nicely, please, please get on your bus and leave now. And most of the women, you know, were taken aback, and they started to move away. But one woman, very strong-headed woman, said, no, I'm not going to leave. I want to go through the neighborhood. And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to touch you. And she puts out her hand to touch him, and the guy jumps back. And she puts out her hand to touch him, and the guy just, and she starts running after him down the Mea Shearim Street, and the women are going, touch him, touch him, touch him. It's a true story. And it's a story that, of course, makes us laugh. But of course, when we think about it, makes us cry, because of the tremendous chasm between different Jews who have a shared history, but are running after each other and can't talk to each other and are in different worlds. And today, what I wanted to explore with you briefly was to look at theological models of how we as Orthodox Jews, and again from a modern Orthodox perspective, which is the perspective that I come from, what have in the last 100 years modern Orthodox thinkers, scholars, what kind of models have been emphasized to try to address the question of how should Orthodoxy, Halachic Judaism, whatever term you want to use, relate to those who have not, who have left the fold of commitment to Halacha as we understand it, both on an individual level, but even the more difficult issue is on the movement level. It's very easy on some level. All of us have big families, and we can all sit around on Thanksgiving. There's a Canadian Thanksgiving also, right? Coming up? No? Not really? Oh, it happened already. I'm sorry. Okay. So, you can sit around the table and have... You don't have turkey. What do you eat? Turkey? Oh. Canadian turkey. Okay. So, you can sit around the table and avoid any controversial issues and, you know, get along. You can see each other. It's machot. People on a human level, you can say hello to each other. But the question is, do we have theological models in which we can, so to speak, recognize and validate where people are at on some level or not? And here I want to look with you together at 5 models that exist, I believe, within the system. If you look at the sheet that I gave out, I didn't know how many to Xerox, so please, if you don't have one, please come forward and share. I Xeroxed about, I think, 30, 35 of these and about 50 of the other ones. And so we'll all share together and learn together. I first want to start with an attitude which you sometimes hear in some Orthodox circles, which I believe is morally scandalous and really out of the pale the idea of indifference, of not caring. A Jew has to care where their other Jewish neighbors, Jewish brethren and sisters are at, spiritually and physically. Not just physically as we know, but also spiritually. That's what it means to be part of a family. It means to be concerned about somebody. Not to only be concerned about yourself and your little circle, but really to care, to cry. Even if we understandably, don't throw stones and condemn people who throw stones, it should bother us internally. When the Jewish people, as one great Gadol once said, that half of Klal Yisrael doesn't know what Shema Yisrael is. It should bother us that half of Klal Yisrael doesn't know what Shema Yisrael is. And there's an amazing passage in Maimonides in Sefer HaMitzvot. I think it's the only place in the entire corpus of Maimonidean literature where he uses this term. Maimonides, in source number one, in the Sefer HaMitzvot, writes, Mitzvah Reishei, the Mitzvah of Tochachav, reproof. Reproof is not only saying, oh, rah, 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 you did something wrong. The Mitzvah is based on the following concept. He should sivanu lehochiach hachote. It is a commandment to reprove the sinner. O mishir tzelachto, or someone who wants to sin, ulimno tomimenu b'ma'amar v'tochicha, ve'ein ra'ui lanu shiomar echad mimenu. And one should not be this kind of laissez-faire kind of attitude, which when I taught Yeshiva High School, I used to hear all the time. Ani lo echta, I'm not sinning. Ve'im echta zulati, ma'li dinoim elohav. It's between him and God. Rabbi, that's when I teach Yeshiva High School. Rabbi, why do you care whether this kid is doing this or doing that? It's between him and God. It's not your business. Western liberalism. We're not supposed to care about, it's his private, it's personal conscience. Two consenting adults, whatever term you want to use, it's private. Says Rambam, V'im yachtazu lati mali dinoi melohav, ze hefech ha-Torah. It's an amazing phrase. It's against, not only against the Torah, it's the opposite of what Torah teaches, that God came down at Sinai and not only gave a covenant to each individual. Religion is not just a private thing, which is, of course, the whole nature of Western democracy. It's about God entering into a covenant with a people. Mamlechet Kohanim v'goy kadosh. And so says Rambam, Aval anachnu mitzuvim shelo nimreh v'shelo nazov zulatenu v'umatenu shenimreh. But we're commanded not to rebel against God, nor to let anyone else. Now, it could take different forms, as the halakha says. Sometimes tochacha takes the form, it's a goal-oriented mitzvah. Sometimes it means, in certain societies, that you should get up and give fire and brimstone lectures and speeches. Sometimes it means with subtle persuasion. Sometimes it means interacting. But the point that I want to make from this Rambam is the idea of indifference. The idea that we shouldn't care. As long as our yeshivot or our shuls are packed, or as long as our camps are okay, we don't care what happens to the rest of Klal Yisrael. I remember many years ago, it used to get me sick, but you sometimes would find that people would somehow be happy when statistics would be published in the Israeli newspapers about how, you know, there's X percentage of drug abuse in Chiloni schools, and there's only very little percentage in Dati schools, whatever it was. Shouldn't be happy. We should be crying. We should be crying about this. We should feel that relationship, that it's not Yenim, it's not somebody else, but it's our brothers and sisters who are in this boat. So that's the first attitude that any Jew has to have about wherever other Jews are on the spiritual continuum. So first of all, simply to care. We have to care and not simply abandon and simply think in terms of, as I once heard a friend of mine in the Haredi community talk about Shemin Zayizach, that we're only caring about the pure oil and we don't care about the rest of Klal Yisrael, or to care about the She'eris HaPleita, right? That only the remnant and the rest of the people, you know, that's it. That's the way it's going to be. It's going to be simply, those are the casualties of war. There are five models that I believe exist and have and exist within Orthodox community. One which I think is certainly adopted as well by the Haredi community, and four which have been adopted by the modern Orthodox, or potentially can be adopted by the modern Orthodox community. The first one is based on the Rambam and the Chazon Ish, source 2 and 3. The first one is the famous concept of Tinok Shenishba, the famous concept of the child captured amongst the Gentiles. The Rambam, in discussing the notion of kefira, the notion of rejection, of emunah, rejection of Torah faith, Maimonides talks about the very terrible things you're supposed to do to a kofir, to an apikoros. If you look in Talmudic law, it speaks very harshly about what you're supposed to do. So the Rambam says, all this is true, source number 2. All these harsh statements in the Talmud refer to people who consciously, willingly rejected Torah. They were the founders of the movement. That these people who were the original founders of the movements of Sadduceeism or Baitusim or the Karaites, the first Anan ben David, the first Karaites, those are the people that the Talmud would have such harsh rhetoric about and harsh halacha about. However, says Rambam, Aval b'nei ha-to'im ha'elo v'nei b'neihem. However, the children and the children's children who grew up in this kind of an ideology, who grew up in this kind of a system that says that halacha is not a binding system, but halacha is a choice. Whatever ideology they grew up in, and they grew up in those kind of camps and in this kind of school system, says Rambam, one cannot hold responsible. Vinoldu bein hakara'im. Notice for Rambam scholars, it's very interesting. The Rambam starts with Tzadok and Baitos from the time of the Second Temple period, and all of a sudden shifts to talk about the Karaites, which was historically the issue that he confronted during his day and age. And it's very interesting, very subtle move by the Rambam from Tzadok and Baitos to the Karaim, to the Karaites. And the Rambam says, but when it comes to the children who've grown up in a Karaite culture, it's like a child who was captured and raised as a Christian, was raised amongst the... So from the perspective of the Rambam, and the Rambam says, V'eino zariz b'achut, sharehu ke'anus. He is ke'anus. And even if he learned afterwards, this is what he's grown up with. He's grown up with the notion that there are 3 kinds of Judaisms or 4 kinds of Judaisms. He's grown up with the notion that halakha is not binding. He's grown up with, or she's grown up with, all kinds of notions. And therefore, you cannot hold people responsible. You cannot use the terminology of the Talmud, like an apikores or a kofir. It's simply not applicable for generations on. Or, in a much more radical statement, look at source 3, Chazon Ish, the famous scholar in Eretz Yisrael, who was considered the intellectual halachic leader of Haredi Judaism in Israel until he passed away in the mid-50s. And the Chazon Ish writes that many of the halachot, the very harsh halachot, the Ein Moridin Elab, the halacha of Moridin, the halacha that you're supposed to basically kill or let die a kofir, Ela bizman shahashkato yichbarach gluya. It's at a time when divine providence is evident. And someone who rejects Torah mitzvot is making a conscious rejection of the truth. Kimo bizman shayu nisim mitzuyim. When the time when there was actually clear-cut miracles. But today, says Chazon Ish, and in that society, the importance of maintaining the integrity of the community was such that we could do very harsh things to the kofrim, says Chazon Ish. Aval, skip about 4 or 5 lines. Aval bizman ha-helem, but today, in a time where we don't see God, v'nichrita ha-emunah min dalat ha'am, where even simple people are cut off from faith, ein b'maseh ho-radah geder ha-pirza, if we act harshly to what halakha considers sinners, if we act harshly, this will be counterproductive to the goal of halakha, of maintaining the integrity of the system. Ein b'maseh horada geder hapirza. It doesn't fix the hole. Ela hosafat hapirza. This will simply add to the breach. Shiyu beinein k'maseh hashchata v'alimut. It will simply be viewed as violent religious coercion. Brutal. V'kevan shekol atzmenu l'takein, since the entire purpose of all the laws are to try to make sure that there's more commitment to the system rather than less commitment, Va'aleinu lachziram va'avotot ahava. Today, the desideratum, the mandate, is to bring back Jews with ropes of love. What today is called the Kiruv movement, or whatever term you want to use. All kinds of, you know, Esha Torah or Sameach, JS, whatever term you want to use. This model, notice, doesn't address anything about the content or the value of what non-Orthodox Jews or Jewish movements are doing. It sees them as sinners. It doesn't change what they do from sin to something of value. But it says that it doesn't matter because we have to look at it in socio-historical terms. And in socio-historical terms, the reality is that people who've grown up for 200 years since the Enlightenment in this kind of a culture, where religion is personal choice, where religion is something that you cannot impose on other people, or where they see things, etc., etc., simply to treat it with the same categories that the Mishnah and the Gemara uses is inappropriate. This is said by the Chazon Ish. Not some left-wing rabbi sitting over here in New York or in Toronto. Okay. But the model doesn't address the content of the value system. That's model one, and model one is something that even most Haredi Jews, except on the very, very fringes, would accept and would buy into. And that's basically the whole mandate of the Kiruv movement. But there's four other models, which I think are more productive in terms of, because first of all, I don't think that many non-Orthodox Jews like to see themselves as Tinok Shenishba, especially serious non-Orthodox Jews. And I don't think it gets us very far in terms of real, honest discussion and interaction. Because if you're treating me in almost a patronizing fashion as a Tinok Shenishba, it's not going to get us very far. There's a second model, and this is the model that was developed by Rabbi Soloveitchik Zatzal, by the Rav, our great mentor, in the 50s, when he identified and became the major leader of religious Zionism in the United States, the intellectual leader of the Mizrahi, as well as broke ranks with the other great Rosh Yeshivas of his time, who in 1956, issued the famous quote-unquote psak, which isn't really a psak because it doesn't make any halakhic argument. But basically in 1956, I'm sure some of people will remember, or students of history will remember, up until that time in American Jewry, there was a number of umbrella organizations that worked together. The most famous was called the Synagogue Council of America, in which Orthodox, Reform, and conservative rabbis worked together on issues mostly dealing with the secular government, anti-Semitism, support for Israel, helping out religious schools, etc., etc. Many public policy issues. Religion in the army, the Korean War, the World War II had just finished. And in 1956, a group of Rosh Yeshiva, led by Rav Aaron Cutler, Zichron Levracha, issued a psak, which said that no Orthodox rabbi can belong to any of these type of umbrella groups. That by definition, to belong to one of these umbrella groups, either an organization like the OU, the Union of Orthodox Jewish Congregations, or an organization, or the Synagogue Council, or an individual rabbi, to belong to the New York Board of Rabbis, or the Toronto Board of Rabbis, I don't know if there's such a thing, is inappropriate. And ipso facto confers legitimacy on non-Orthodox rabbis and movements, and one cannot do that based on the principle of Al Titchaver La Rasha, and one cannot give any legitimacy, no quarter. And this became the ethos of the right-wing community in America and in other places in the world, which was in many ways a continuation of the famous Ausstrittgemeinde, the idea of separate communities of Hirsch, the Hirschian model. Hirsch, while he was modern Orthodox in the Torah in Derech Eretz sense, he was a big believer in separatist orthodoxy, that one doesn't participate together with the rest of the community because one is giving tacit legitimacy to non-Orthodox ideology and movements, and one cannot do that. Rabbi Soloveitchik disagreed, and Rabbi Soloveitchik would not sign the psak, and that became the policy of the RCA, and made a very important distinction based on this
famous notion here in Source 4. And he made it both in relationship to the Zionist movement as well as to the relationship with conservative and reform. And that is that he basically argued this very beautiful piece called Kol Dodido Fake, in which he argued that if you look in Jewish history, there are two covenants. There's the Brit Sinai and the Brit Mitzrayim. There's the covenant of Egypt, which was forged in history, in blood, of the historical experience of the Jew. What he called the covenant of fate, F-A-T-E, Brit Yehud, I'm sorry, Brit Goral, the Brit of fate, that we come from a shared past. We're experiencing a shared history now. We're under slavery, anti-Semitism, the Holocaust, Israel, Russian Jewry, Syrian Jewry. We all together share the historical reality of past, present, and future. But there's also an ultimate Brit Yehud. There's a covenant, a second covenant, represented by Sinai, of a covenant of trying to not simply exist as a people for the point of existence, but existing for a certain purpose, that we want to transform ourselves in the world. Torah, mitzvot, messianic aim, tikkun olam, whatever term. And that these are certain values that revolve around halakha, etc., etc. And the Rav writes that we have to understand these two covenants, which he also termed in another famous essay, the idea of relating to the Jewish people as a historical entity, a socio-historical entity, Knesset Yisrael across the generations, as opposed to a kind of metaphysical entity. And he said that when it comes to issues of Brit Goral, of the physical safety and the physical reality of the Jewish people, we have to work together with all Jews across the spectrum. We have to sit at the same table together with reform, conservative, socialist, Bundist, Yiddishist, anarchist, whatever it is, we have to sit together in every forum that we can on the issues of what he called klape chutz, when they relate to the Jewish people in its relationship to the non-Jewish world, certainly, and in relationship to the issues of the physical survival and the physical maintenance and the physical well-being of the Jewish people. And any types of things which don't involve the details of halakha, what he called the klape pnim, where we're not talking about, okay, we together are going to decide now that we're going to change the details of the laws of Geirus, or we're going to change the details of the laws of Kashrus. Those things, the Rav said, one should not get involved in. But any area of klape chutz, any area that deals, we should work together. And so therefore the Rav supported the whole idea of religious Zionism, which works together with other Zionist groups and works together to sit in the government and to try to build the Jewish people together and build the State of Israel together, and supported the RCA and the OU sitting together on these umbrella boards in the interests of the Jewish people. And this recognizes that many of the projects and many of the things that non-Orthodox movements do, even if we don't share the same understanding of Brit Yehud, we don't share the same understanding of what Torah means, of what mitzvah means, of what the ultimate looking, or the ultimate goal of Judaism is, of Tikkun Olam, B'malchut Shaddai exactly means. But we can share a sense of Brit Goral, and we need to work together on those things, and we need to not highlight the things that divide us, but we need to focus on those things which unite us in the Brit Goral. That's a different model already. That's already recognizing that even if there are many theological and halachic things that we cannot work together on, and that we can't recognize and we can't grant legitimacy to, however, we certainly there are many positive things that are done by non-Orthodox Jews and non-Orthodox movements as Jewish things to maintain the well-being and the interaction and the growth of the Jewish people. That's the second model. You turn the page to the third model. The third model goes further. The third model already, the third model already goes beyond the Rav basing himself on the Rav, but goes further. And that's the model that's developed by two of the leading thinkers, Yibadlu L'Chaim Arukim, they should live for a long life, of modern Orthodoxy, my Rebbe, Mori V'Rabbi, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Shlita, and the past president of Yeshiva University, Rabbi Norman Lamb, who's recently retired. Rabbi Lichtenstein addressed these issues in print a number of years ago, almost 20 years ago, in a number of symposia, that were printed in Tradition Magazine and in Jewish Action. And I, on the flip side of this page, I xeroxed some very important statements that unfortunately, there are many Orthodox rabbis and spokesmen that somehow have a problem signing on to. And I don't see why, but I've heard things that trouble me very much, but these should be the mottos of any serious, and certainly any serious modern Orthodox theology today. Rav Aaron wrote in 1982, "Nor do I share the glee some feel over the prospective demise of the competition, the conservative reform. Surely we have many sharp differences with the conservative reform movements, and these should not be sloughed over or blurred. However, we also share many values with them, and this too should not be obscured. The statement that we can say in public that we share many values, not only in terms of Brit Goral, to use the Rav's terms, but even in Brit Yehud, values of Tzedakah, values of, in many areas, mitzvot, values of chesed that we can share and work on together. And of course, if we transcend, their disappearance might strengthen us in some respects, but would unquestionably weaken us in others. And of course, if we transcend our own interests and think of the people currently served by these movements, many of them, both presently and potentially, are well beyond our reach or ken. How would they or Klal Yisrael as a whole be affected by such a change? Can anyone responsibly state that it is better for a marginal Jew in Dallas or in Dubuque to lose his religious identity altogether rather than drive to his temple?" I've heard rabbis say that. Yeah. It's better that somebody stay home and watch Seinfeld reruns on Friday night. People watch Seinfeld in Canada? It's okay. Okay. So it's better to watch Seinfeld reruns and eat non-kosher Chinese food at home than to go to a Reform temple. Shomu Shamayim. Rav Aaron is saying here, did anybody responsibly think that? You ask me a shaila as a rav. You are an individual Jew. You have a choice. You're becoming a Baal Tshuva. And you ask me, should I drive to the temple or should I stay home and daven for my art scroll sitter? It's better that I should stay home and daven for my art scroll sitter. But if you ask from a Klal Yisrael point of view, not as a shaila, but from the total perspective, of course, it's better that people be connected. And if anyone has ever done any research, one knows from the studies that most Jews who come back to any form of serious orthodoxy were Jews who were once affiliated in some way to the community on any level, rather than people who were totally disconnected on any level. And in much sharper, not sharper, but even more explicit fashion, a few years later, Rav Aaron, in a piece in Jewish Action, wrote the following, number 6. For those who don't have it in front of you, I'll read it carefully. "With respect to reducing polarization, I'm convinced that the best approach does not call for minimizing difference, but rather for maximizing community. Basic ideological differences do exist, and to dismiss or blur them is both irresponsible and anti-halachic. Pluralism, the way some people want, what in philosophy, we had a lot of philosophers here today, hard pluralism, there's two kinds of pluralism. There's called hard pluralism in philosophy and soft pluralism. Hard pluralism is what kind of everything is equal. I'm okay, you're okay, we're all equivalent. Hard pluralism is something that an Orthodox Jew cannot accept. We make certain truth claims about Torah Sinai, Torah Mi-Sinai, and we may have debates on the details, but we make certain truth claims. We simply cannot simply yield legitimacy and say that everything is all the same. We cannot be hard pluralists and be serious Orthodox Jews. But, says Rav Aaron, and therefore Orthodoxy cannot accord secularists to dissent as Hechsher they so insistently demand. We can, however, place greater emphasis upon the factors, without denying difference, that transcend it, upon confraternity, upon historical and existential ties. That's called Brit Goral. But more than that, says Rav Aaron, in addition to that, upon essential components of a shared moral and spiritual vision, upon elements of both a common faith and a common destiny. That's what Orthodox rabbis, somehow they're afraid. Rav Aaron's a gadol. If he can say it, I don't see why Orthodox rabbis can't feel comfortable saying it. That we share many common values and many common destinies with Reform and conservative rabbis, with sincere ones. We should not only concede but assert that whatever their deviations, other camps include people genuinely in search of the Rabbona Shalom. That secular Jewry too harbors moral idealism and a commitment to Klal Yisrael. And that while we reject leveling compromises, we strive for understanding and respect. Okay? That we, in another context, Rav Aaron once commented, he said that we have to recognize, again, when you deal with sincere people who are sincerely working with this framework as their guidepost, not simply because they just do anything, but sincere people, we have to recognize that there are many Mevakshei Hashem in all the movement, even if we, from our perspective, feel that they haven't found Hashem. But to see that people are Mevakshei Hashem, seekers of God, and to recognize and appreciate religiosity across the board. Or in Rabbi Lam's formulation, Rabbi Lam, in a famous talk in 1986, distinguished, if you look at the right-hand side, between three categories, philosophically, between validity, dignity, and legitimacy. It's a very, very important three distinctions. Validity, from the Latin word of validus, means that from a functional point of view, non-Orthodox rabbis are valid leaders of Jewish religious communities. That means that lemaisa, practically, they operate as spiritual leaders, they guide people, they help people, they do things without getting into the value judgment of the legitimacy of it. To make believe like they don't exist is simply silly. That's point one. Point two, if you look in the fourth paragraph in Rabbi Lam, this is from his book he recently published called 70 Faces, which are a collection of his wonderful two-volume collection of his essays. As an Orthodox Jew, I have no trouble in acknowledging the functional validity of non-Orthodox rabbinic leadership, but in also granting that non-Orthodox rabbis and lay people may possess spiritual dignity. If they are sincere, if they believe in God, if they are motivated by principle and not by convenience or trendiness, if they endeavor to carry out the consequences of their faith in a consistent manner, then they are religious people. In this sense, they are no different from Orthodox Jews who may attain such spiritual dignity or may not, if their faith is not genuinely felt and if they do not struggle to have their conduct conform with their principles. Phonies abound in all camps and should be respected by no one. And sincerely devout people exist everywhere. But neither functional validity nor spiritual dignity are identical with Jewish legitimacy. Validity describes the fact of one's religious existence. Dignity refers to the quality of one's religious posture, not to its content. It is the latter which determines what we are calling legitimacy. I can respect the sincerity and the dignity and recognize that we share common values without necessarily saying that whole line, hook and sinker, that I accept legitimacy as a valid expression of Judaism in the same way that I believe that halakhic Judaism is a valid expression of Judaism. And this is a very important, this is a different model. This is taking the Rav a step further. Language, but it opens up opportunities for us to deal together with non-Orthodox rabbis and non-Orthodox movements on those things which unite us rather than those things which divide us. We all know the things that divide us. And it's silly to make believe like they're going to go away. And a pluralism which asks us to give up our most basic beliefs and that they should give up their most basic beliefs is silly. It's not real. And that's not pluralism. It's pluralism, but it's not a pluralism that any serious person can make a compromise with. But these models afford us the opportunity to have joint learning programs, to have joint chesed programs, whether it's in UJA or between synagogues, working together on things, and not to get caught up in the issues that may have been, and historically, so important in the 50s, when Orthodoxy was on the decline, But today, certainly, that's not the issue. To get so caught up in that, I think, is really not productive. Finally, there's the model of Rav Kook, which is from the sheet that I gave out, the last sheet that I gave to you. And this is, of course, a more philosophically, mystically oriented perspective, which also has tremendous ramifications. Just a little background in mysticism. Rav Kook, in mysticism, there was in Kabbalah, as well as in Chassidut, there's a concept called Naran, Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama. That each individual person has Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama, which refers to the physical part of the body, the Nefesh, the Ruach, which refers more to emotions, instincts, attitudes, feelings, and the Neshama, which refers to the soul, that ephemeral quality, spirituality, the desire to connect to God, holiness, all the terms you want to use. Rav Kook, in his greatness, went beyond the Kabbalistic notion of Naran, of Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama, in relationship to the individual, and applied it as well in the realm of nations. Rav Kook, in many ways, was influenced by Hegelian thought. Not that he sat and read Hegel in German, but he had friends like the Nazir Rav David HaKohen, who did read Hegel in the original, and the whole zeitgeist of the time was saturated with this type of thought, which spoke of different nations having also the equivalent of Naran, that each culture has, and each society, whether it's Germany or France or America or Canada and Israel, has in it Naran, has in it Nefesh, Ruach, and Neshama. And Rav Kook had this amazing passage, which I want to use for a third model, in his relationship to the concept of how does he interact, what's his perspective on the non-religious Zionists that he came into interaction with and was, on one hand, very supportive of, on the other hand, very critical of. Rav Kook is sometimes painted in these kind of superficial colors as this, you know, kind of, you know, oh, I'm okay, you're okay, happy, slappy guy that just loved all Jews and was so happy. Rav Kook also wrote very critical things of many of Elazar ben Yehuda from the dictionary, was one of the leaders. He wrote a blistering article against Elazar ben Yehuda. He was very critical of many things. Rav Kook was, on the one hand, a very compassionate and open person, but also was not above criticizing what he saw as flaws from a religious point of view in the non-religious Zionists. And yet, Rav Kook worked with the non-religious Zionist movement. He did not take the position of the Haredi community. And not only did he work on a functional level, but believed theologically that what he was doing was an expression of the correct way to act, because he had a whole theological view of history, a la Hegel / Kabbalah / Hasidut, in which he saw all the manifestations of movements in real life as partial manifestations of truth. Rav Kook, as a Kabbalist, believed that we experience only one part of truth. And even though we may be closer to truth, all the great movements in history, whether it's socialism, Bundism, feminism, secularism, this ism or that ism, contain within them certain movements. If you believe that all of life and history and reality is an expression of the divine, and even if they have a lot of dross, D-R-O-S-S, on them, even though if they have a lot of bad on them, there's a kernel of truth or some power that God is revealing in history through them, and it's through the amalgam of learning from these different movements something that needs to be learned, that we move the world further along and closer to its perfection, l'taken olam malchut shaddai. And so Rav Kook, I xerox to you a passage from Orot. Okay, the school comes from the name comes from a book. Okay, it's not the other way around. Okay, so
Sometimes I met somebody once who thought Maimonides was named after a school, but of course, okay. But it happens sometimes. Okay. So Rav Kook in Orot writes the following. And some of the people, when they first saw this, and they didn't understand what he was writing, because they didn't understand Kabbalah or Chassidut, they went crazy. But if you understand Kabbalah and Chassidut, you know exactly where Rav Kook is coming from. But they also misquoted him. So listen to what Rav Kook writes. Hanefesh shel poshei Yisrael. The nefesh here is a specific term. Nefesh, the physical manifestation of the poshei Yisrael, the non-religious Zionist. Be'ikvus of the Mashiach in Messianic times. Otam shehem mitchabrim ba'ahava l'nyanei klal Yisrael l'eretz Yisrael t'chiyat ha'umah. Who are connected to the concept of national Jewish revival, the land of Israel, and the revival of the people, the land, the language, all the things that we know about. He yoter mitukenet is more perfected, mehanefesh shel shlomei emunei Yisrael, is more perfected than the nefesh of the religious shlomei emunei Yisrael. Whoa! What does that mean? What that means is that in the time that we live in Ikvus the Mashiach, says Rav Kook, that he was experiencing, the nefesh, the physical understanding of the importance of national revival, that the Jewish people cannot simply continue to live in Galut, but they need to live in their own state, and they need to revive themselves economically, and politically, and physically. That understanding is much more developed amongst the non-religious than the religious, which is a true fact at that time, no doubt about it. She'ein lahem zeh ha'yitaron shel ha'hargashah ha'atznit l'tovat ha'klal u'binyan ha'umah v'aretz. And they don't have, because they don't have this advantage of this inert feeling of being connected to the notion of the good of the whole and the development and the binyan and the building of the nation as a whole. Meaning that God chose, for whatever reason, to express this idea which is inherent in Judaism, but because of the galut, we have lost it, because we've been 2,000 years away from independence. So in the late 1800s, and the early 1900s, for Rav Kook reading history, God chose to express an idea which is a true idea through the vehicle of the non-religious. Aval haruach, but the ruach of the naran, nefesh, ruach, neshama. Aval haruach hu mitukan harbe yoter eitzel yirei Hashem v'shomrei Torah mitzvot. Afal pi shargasha tzvit v'yitarot shol koch pula v'nei kaitro inam adayin amitzot etzlam. But the ruach, the spiritual feelings, emotions, meaning while politics and economics and army and all those things in 1905 were more developed within the world of the secular, many of the spiritual ideas that are at the core of the existence of the Jewish people are much more developed in the religious community than they are in the non-religious community. And the goal is that eventually, through the interaction, says Rav Kook, he continues, a couple of lines later, Hatikun shiavod de oro shel Mashiach shiazor lazeh harbe devar ha'itpashtut shel Talmud razei Torah v'gilui rot chachmat Elohim b'chol tzorotea hu shiatzu Yisrael aguda achat. As the divine messianic era unfolds and all the hidden light of Torah will come up, then each one will help perfect the other. The titukan hanefesh shel ha'yireim shomrei Torah al yedei shleimut hanefesh Shepushim haTovim, etc., etc. VaRuach shel haPushim titukan yashpatam. Each one will fructify, will help fructify the other in developing that which is missing. Every person, every group, in its interaction with each other, will hopefully work together and help fill the gap of the other one. This is Rav Kook, and he develops this in many contexts, mystically and philosophically. What that meant for Rav Kook was, therefore, Rav Kook rejected in a very famous letter to Rav Yitzchak Isaac Halevi and to others, he rejected the Hirshian model of separatist orthodoxy in Eretz Yisrael. He saw it as Avodah Zarah. He actually uses that term. It's Avodah Zarah to try to create an Eda Haredis, or to create a separatist orthodoxy. We need an orthodoxy which is Klal Yisrael connected, because that will help the orthodoxy develop itself in the positive way, and the orthodoxy and the commitment will help the Klal Yisrael develop. And it's the interaction of all these movements which will ultimately reach a point where there will be perfection, etc., etc. And to take the model of Rav Kook, well, Rav Kook for not one second gave up staunchly his commitment to halakha and to criticizing breaches in the halakha as he understood it, and to be very critical of the non-orthodox people, movements, and things and writings that people like Elazar ben Yehuda wrote in Hatkufa and Hamelit and all these newspapers. He understood, he had a perspective that maybe God, and he believed truly God, was doing something through history. And I think that this is a very tantalizing theological model that speaks to that there may be things, for whatever reason, that orthodoxy, for whatever reasons, in its confrontation with the Enlightenment, in its confrontation with emancipation, pushed to the side and wasn't able to think about for whatever reason, and that through other movements, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has decided to bring to the fore. Bedafka needed a movement, whether it was about social action, whether it's about women's issues, whatever it is, that to need to prod orthodoxy to start to think about certain things. With internally in the system, it couldn't. Now, this is some throwing out a theological model. And this is something that certainly, in the perspective of Rav Kook, is something that we need to think about. That doesn't mean that we change and stop being Orthodox Jews. It doesn't mean that, but we recognize that there are certain values that may be brought to the fore, that we should be also listening, that we should also be hearing, that maybe there are other Jews that have something to say to us and to emphasize that can make us think about becoming better Jews and look back into the tradition itself to understand that maybe there are echoes of certain things within the tradition, while at the same time maintaining the integrity of halakha, the process of halakha, the way things work out. But maybe that confrontation with not being able to ignore certain ideas in the ultimate scheme of God's plan of the world and history is what God wants to unfold in history, a la Rav Kook's Hegelian model here in Oroth and in other places. And so we have here four very serious models of how Orthodox Jews are supposed to, or I believe should, interact with non-Orthodox Jews and more radically non-Orthodox movements. One is the whole Tinok Shenishpa / there's no apikores b'yamenu statement of the Chazon Ish and the Rambam, which is something that all Orthodox Jews can buy into, which leads to the whole Kiruv notion that we're not supposed to be cutting Jews off, but we're supposed to be inviting and welcoming and warm. The second model that the Rav Zatzal developed of Brit Goral and Brit Yehud, the notion of a shared covenant of fate. Even if we don't agree on the details of a covenant of faith, but we share covenant of faith, and we should try to work on all those things that bind us together, rather than create a separatist orthodoxy that has nothing to do with the rest of the community. Number three, the development of that idea in the writings of Rav Lichtenstein and Rabbi Lam, where we also recognize that there are also values that we share in common that we can work together on. And to recognize the spiritual dignity of non-Orthodox Jews, sincere. Again, if somebody's not sincere, they're not sincere. It doesn't matter if they're a chassid or an ultra-reform rabbi. It doesn't matter. It's not just ultra-Orthodox. We should also use the term ultra-reform. They're also ultra. You can be ultra-reform also. Ultra. But if someone is sincere and holds to their values and is consistent and sincerely believes in what they believe, that we need to recognize that we may share many values of religiosity with them and work together with them on projects for the good of the Jewish people and the community, etc. And finally, and that people are mevakshei Hashem even if we don't agree on all the solutions. And finally, the Rav Kookian model
which allowed for the interaction with the non-religious Zionist movements, the different movements that Rav Kook interacted with, because of a recognition, a theological model, which says that since even orthodoxy is not the end-all and be-all of reality, because all of religion is a manifestation, it cannot capture everything about the essence of God and the world, because God is beyond any limitation. And so maybe there are ideas and values that are being trying to be communicated to us through movements and through ideas that are seeping through in the world, and that is something that means that there may be value in all kinds of movements that we interact with. And that's going to try to find the positive in other people and other movements may be a move that we need to work on. So these are four models that I think are very significant, and certainly we need to emphasize the potential positive aspects of it, especially in a world of growing polarization. And we understand the growing polarization. How can I work with this one when they don't believe in this? But as Rav Aaron said, we need to emphasize, we all know what divides us. We need to emphasize those things of greater confraternity. The things that we can share and work together on for the greater good of the Jewish people. I guess I have a few minutes to take some questions, and thank you for your hakshava.
Thank you, Rabbi. I appreciate your comments. So it's now Sunday night at 6 o'clock. We get up tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. What do we do?
Who do we call
and how do we start?
So again, I'm not privy to all the politics in Toronto, but it means that we need to produce rabbis, and that's one of the things that, you know, my rabbinical school is involved in. We need to produce rabbis that are not afraid to talk and sit down with Reform and conservative rabbis about things that are of benefit to the Jewish people. It's not 1950 or 55 where every Orthodox shul is somehow going over to the other side. It's not 1955 where people are taking down mechitzas. That's not what's happening. Orthodoxy is very vibrant. Orthodoxy is very self-confident. Our schools are full, yeshivot are full, Israel. We need to start talking about the things and working with people as much as we can, but without being asked to give up our values. I very truly believe I will speak anywhere I'm invited without having to give up things that I shouldn't have to give up. I shouldn't have to give up my commitment to Torah mitzvot and emunah and Torah misinai. And we should create forums where that can happen, where people do not have to give up their basic values. And we need to create forums where we can work together. Now, sometimes people are obstructionists, and they don't want to work together. If they don't want to work together, they don't want. But if I know of many cases where rabbis have worked together very productively. And even on technical matters, very good things can happen. I have a very good friend who's a rabbi in Riverdale, New York, who's very friendly with the local Reform rabbi. And because of that, this local Reform rabbi, whenever a couple is getting divorced, refers them to him to make sure that they get a get. Now, that only exists because there's discussion, interaction, and that's just on a practical level. So what I would say is that we need to produce rabbis that are not afraid about this, and we need to have balabatim who are going to support them and not, you know, criticize them every time they do something or their picture is in the newspaper, or they're criticized by the right-wing rabbis in the community that are going to support them, really support them, and not duck under the covers or go into a manhole cover, but are going to support any efforts that can help the Jewish people in whatever model you want to choose. I'm not saying that one model is better than the other model, but I think that these models exist within modern Orthodoxy, and we need to trumpet them and not run away and simply give in to the most obscurantist forces in the Orthodox community today.
Yeah, I think you agree. One of the problems is I don't think we have the time to create the rabbis. I think we can't create them from new. We have to create from what we have. The other reality, the tachlis, is on the other side of the table, we have to have people who are prepared to talk.
Correct. But
and
that's
the other part of the equation.
Correct. I want to tell you that you're right. There are many people on the other side of the table who are not interested in working together and only engage in orthodox bashing. So people like that, there's not much that we can do on a practical level. But I also believe very much that we also need to, whenever a conservative forum invites me to speak, I will speak, because they don't have the opportunity to hear orthodox people. And I want them to hear, obviously without compromising my principles. I won't daven in a shul, that doesn't have machitz or whatever like that. But on a Wednesday night, if I'm invited to the Jewish Center in Comac, Long Island to give a talk, I will go. Because I want to tell you, and they eat it up. If it's good Torah, and it's interesting, and it's and we don't have fangs, and the Orthodox rabbi who will talk to them like human beings, and will interact with them, it's a tremendous Kiddush Hashem, and it brings people closer.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Go ahead. Another question?
I wanted to ask you, to what extent would the principles that you've described extend to non-Jewish groups, groups of other religions or whatever? And given that the disputes between Orthodoxy and the other groups often revolve about the question of who is a Jew, how would that influence what you said?
In Rav Kook's model, and he's Allah, also the Rambam, in Hilchot Melachim, the Rambam talks about the fact that even other religions play a role, in the uncensored version of the Rambam, that other religions play a role in bringing the Word of God into the world, other monotheistic religions. And Rav Kook also writes that there, with all the problems that other religions have brought to the world, and including all the anti-Semitism, there's much positive, even in paganism, that is brought to the world. Unfortunately, it's under layers and layers of dross. And Rav Kook would extend his model to other religions as well, in an ultimate sense. But we have enough trouble, internally, before we get to the ecumenism of other religions. Your second question about, yes, I agree with you. Who is a Jew is so difficult that it sometimes makes other things almost impossible. It's one of the greatest tragedies in the world, and I've said it to my Reform friends and Reform rabbi friends. The Reform movement, I thought, made the most irresponsible and the least Klal Yisrael concerned decision in 1983 when they voted patrilineal descent, and it was an irresponsible decision that didn't take into account Klal Yisrael. And maybe if there had been more interaction between the Jewish people before that, maybe people would not have felt so isolated that by 1983, they didn't really care what Orthodoxy said or what the conservative movement said. So the point was, we're just going to do what we think is good for our own movement. Movements think about movements instead of about Klal Yisrael. If we had not gotten to that point, maybe things would not happen. You know that in 1956, the Rav Zatzal and Professor Lieberman Zatzal from the seminary spent a year working on having a joint Beit Din between the conservative movement and the Orthodox movement, where all Gerus and all Gittin and all Kiddushin would be under a joint Beit Din that would be mutually acceptable to the Orthodox and the conservatives. It would only have halachically observant and acceptable Dayanim. And it was very close, but it didn't happen, partially because Professor Lieberman couldn't guarantee that every conservative rabbi would follow the decisions of that Beit Din. So it's a tragedy, but maybe if we interacted on certain things, maybe we could reverse the process of some of those things. I don't know the answer, but you're right. When you're dealing with non-Jews in the same, it's something that we can't do, but not every Reform rabbi, Reform Jew is necessarily not Jewish. There are many, and certainly conservative Judaism doesn't accept the patrilineal descent decision. And so I still think that we have a majority of people in all the movements that are Jewish, but the schism is coming. It's a terrible thing. Yes, Dr. Jeff.
You talked about creating rabbis who are open to this concept.
Right.
Here we have a few in the city who obviously are open to the concept because they brought you to speak about this, but we have Balabatim who don't allow them. I mean, and that's as big a problem. How do
right.
we deal with that?
So that's what you have to, I don't know.
You get Nayavala, right. Change the shul, right. Change the electorate. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, except to educate Balabhaktins, to show them that there's other models, and you're not less frum. Just because somebody gets up and says you're less frum, don't buy into that. And understand that there are great, you know, great Talmidei Chachamim and great Poskim and great Gedolim within the modern Orthodox community that thought of things differently and didn't see. Just because, you know, the separatist orthodoxy of Hirsch or the Brisker Rav won out in certain circles doesn't mean it's the only model. And while there's a Hirsch, there's also a Hildesheimer. And while there's a Rav Aaron Cutler, there's also Rabbi Soloveitchik. And to understand that and to be very, you know, proud, respectful of other people's approach, but not to shirk. And to say that to Balabhaktim and to learn with them and to show them and to say, I'm not going to be frightened by, you know, by invective or things like that. I mean, but, you know, yeah, it takes break the places. It takes people that care about the Jewish people and are not going to be easily warded off by these things. Okay? Thank you very much.
The patrilineal was not 1983. They made that legal, but they've been doing it since 1879, the patrilineal. They've been accepting patrilineal descent.
Okay.